It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Alaska may have more shoreline than the rest of the United States combined, but we probably have the fewest ocean swimmers of any state. It might make more sense to go body surfing in Hawaii, but if you love the ocean, Alaska's waters are a fascinating world to explore as a diver, where discoveries are still being made. And divers tell me that with the right equipment, Alaskan diving is safe and comfortable. On today's show, we're going to talk about underwater adventures with three Alaskan scuba divers who do it frequently. We'll learn how and why you would get into this sport and find out about the adventures they've had and the cool things they've discovered underwater in Alaska. And I know there probably are more than three divers in Alaska, but I've got three pretty experienced ones in the studio with me today. Scott Anderson is owner of Dive Alaska. Thanks for being with us, Scott.
My pleasure.
And Eloise Brown is the dive program coordinator at Alaska Pacific University, which I guess you're teaching students to dive and supporting your educational programs.
Yep, that's right.
Thanks for being with us, Eloise. And Emily Craver is owner of the Last Frontier Diving Shop and a diver yourself, too.
Thanks a lot for having me.
So, Emily, tell me about how you got into diving.
Wow, that's a long story. The short version, though, I wanted to be a diver ever since I could remember, you know, when I was a little kid. And finally had the time and the money at the same time in my late 20s and just decided to go for it. And I lived in Alaska, so I learned to dive in Alaska.
And I've had friends who have sort of been through that same thing. I want to be a diver. I've seen it on TV. I live in Alaska. What do I do now? So, I mean, how do you learn it here in Alaska? How did you get started?
So I went around town to the dive shops and just talked to folks, looked around. I think that we naturally gravitate towards personalities, you know, similar to ours. So I found a shop that I felt like I fit in with and signed up for lessons.
And did you, I mean, you didn't sort of think, oh my God, it's going to be freezing cold. I'm going to like die underwater.
I thought it would be pretty cold. I actually did my certification dives in March, which can be pretty bitter and windy. But when I was in Maui the next month, I thought, gosh, this is really easy. Am I forgetting something? So it definitely made me a more proficient warm water diver.
So so tell me about what is it like to be underwater in Alaska? I mean, you're wearing a dry suit, right?
Dry suit.
So
mm-hmm.
you physically feel warm? You don't
For the
feel
most
cold.
Part. Yeah. Sometimes your hands, feet, face can get a little cold. Uh-huh. But you're usually preoccupied with everything else that's going on. So tend not to think about that so much.
Mm-hmm. And so your hands, feet, and face are the parts that are not covered by the dry suit. And so you're sort of encountering 40-degree water.
They're not as covered. You do have exposure protection, but not the actual dry suit.
Do you wear gloves or something?
You can wear dry gloves or wet gloves. We wear hoods, neoprene hoods on our heads, so you just have a little bit of your cheeks peeking out.
Uh-huh.
And then boots can be part of the dry suit or they can be separate, but you'd at least have dry suit socks underneath.
Huh. Scott, you tell me about your getting into this sport.
I actually learned to dive on a family vacation when I was 16 years old in Hawaii. So I've been diving for a number of years. It was from the age of about 16 to 20, I was kind of active as a vacation diver with my family, and my dad was a diver, so I dove with him a lot. And then in 1990, I hired onto the fire department. I wanted to be a rescue diver for the fire department, so I recertified.
Here in Anchorage?
Yeah.
Were you from Anchorage originally?
Not originally, but since I've been 5 years old, so
okay.
Most of my life. And so I got recertified in Resurrection Bay to suit the, or to satisfy the requirement of me being trained in a dry suit and such. And so from that point, kind of enjoyed it anywhere from infrequently as a vacation sport to up to, now when I'm teaching and diving every weekend.
I would think that being a rescue diver would be a pretty challenging and dangerous occupation.
It can be. And actually, the rescue diver is maybe not the technically correct term. It's public safety diver, which even kind of denotes an additional level of risk because you're expected to jump out of bed at 2 a.m, throw on a dry suit, and swim through pitch black water feeling for, to recover a body or something ominous like that. So not at all as fun as what I do today.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So how long did you do that?
That was 15 years.
Wow.
Retired from that 10 years ago.
I bet that has some stories that go with it.
There are, yeah.
So now you teach people to dive, and what kind of issues do you run into with newbies what kind of misperceptions do you encounter?
Well, that's it. Our biggest challenge is the misperception that it's cold and dark and there's nothing to see, right? So our waters up here, because they're colder, they hold more oxygen. The oxygen feeds the plankton feeds everything else. So we actually have more to see up here than in a lot of warm water places where the water is clear and sterile. So that's the biggest misperception. The biggest challenge is because the water is cold, we dive in dry suits. And a dry suit is a big bag of air that fully encapsulates your body. And as you can imagine, the buoyancy challenges that this air package air ball creates can be a real challenge for students.
Right, I imagine. So a lot more to talk about on that, but I want to talk also to my third guest, Eloise Brown, who's a dive coordinator at APU. And APU is quite a small school, but it has an outdoor experiential kind of emphasis. And so you're using diving to sort of support the educational program there.
Yeah, well, scientific diving, Alaska Pacific University is one of the two programs in Alaska that has a scientific diving program. Also, University of Alaska up in Fairbanks has one. That's where I started cold water diving about 15 years ago. And basically, when I was in college, I decided I wanted to go into marine science as a profession, and I went into a scientific diving program at University of California, Santa Barbara, where I did my undergrad. And I moved up to Fairbanks a while ago because I looked up the webpage, and there was Steve Jewett, the dive safety officer, wearing a dry suit. And I thought, great, I can move to Alaska. My husband's a skier. He likes skiing. I'm an ocean girl. I like the beach. I'm like, we can move to Alaska. I can still dive, and he can still ski. So most scientific divers are out doing research, quantifying habitat, getting down in the underwater environment where it's hard to quantify from a boat. So getting down and really seeing what's out there.
So give me an example of a project that a scientist might be working on. I've seen people using these quadrants and putting them down and counting how many critters are on the seafloor. Is that the sort of thing
a really common objective of a scientific study would be to count or figure out the abundance or biomass of the animals on the seafloor. So that square thing you're talking about is a quadrat. It's a meter square. You put it down. And you count or remove everything within that square meter, and then you do that over and over. You might have a transect tape, which is 20 meters long. You'll swim out, and then you'll do several travel quadrats along the transect, and you'll quantify what's out there. Take that back, and then that helps feed into things like essential fish habitat and
whatever you're studying. Yeah, and it seems kind of cool in that it's got more of a exploration, natural history aspect of it. A lot of marine science ends up being about being on a boat and dropping an instrument down into the water and never really seeing what it is you're studying, and you actually get to go out and sort of swim around and look at it.
Right, that's what I love about diving, definitely. Although I do drop instruments as well. I like to swim mine out.
Oh, really? What do you mean? You go down while the instrument's going down?
Oh, I'm a coastal oceanographer, so I put out ADVs and ADCPs, which measure water currents. And so I've been at the bottom of the seafloor with a boat lowering my instruments with many hundred pounds of weight on them over me, and I'm guiding it down on the reef where I want it to be. I've swam out before with underwater cameras and other things and get my data. It's a great way of non-destructive sampling, basically.
Interesting.
Instead of removing and killing what's down there to count it, you can go down there and dive and measure and leave it down there.
So as a scientist, are you working on research projects now that you're publishing and so forth as an APU dive coordinator, or are you sort of mostly just involved in working with students?
Both. I'm new to APU. I only recently moved back to Alaska from Australia, where I was doing my PhD. So I'm still writing up publications from that. And I did a master's at University of Alaska in Fairbanks 10 years ago. And so I did do scientific research around Alaska, and I'm still developing my new program since I've gotten back.
Huh. So you California, Australia, these seem like places you would dive. And then Alaska, if the only reason you're here is because your husband likes to ski, then I think that you're truly an exceptional spouse. But I mean, is the diving here comparable to those other places, or as interesting, or how do these different places sort of look together in terms of what you can do?
Well, they are different. In cold water and warm water, the species composition is totally different. But I love Alaska. I have for a long time. I love diving in cold water. In fact, I've been colder diving in Australia in 70-degree water in a wetsuit by far than I've ever been in my dry suit. You know, it keeps you warm. You're toasty. I like that.
Wow. Interesting. It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolfworth. We're talking about diving today. And I've got three guests in the studio. Eloise Brown is the dive program coordinator with Alaska Pacific University. Scott Anderson is the owner of Dive Alaska. And Emily Craver is the owner of Last Frontier Diving Shop. Emily, how does this dry suit work? I think a lot of people might not even know what that is.
Sure. So you have a few different styles. You can have a tri-laminate, a bi-laminate, crushed neoprene. Does that cover all of them? I think so. So basically you would wear... generally like long johns or polypro layer and your warm wool socks, and then a thermal undergarment, so maybe fleece or thinsulate, something like that. And then you jump into this big suit that looks pretty big before you get into it. It can have socks or boots attached to it, and generally latex wrist seals and a neck seal, so all that's poking out of your hands and head. And then to keep warm, you actually fill it with air through an inlet valve. And that also adds, as Scott said, buoyancy, which you have to manage.
So it's this insulating layer of air that is actually keeping you warm when you're underwater.
Mm-hmm. So you look a little like the Michelin Man.
These suits must be very expensive, I imagine.
expense is all relative. You know, how much do you spend on golf clubs or new skis, bindings?
Right. Well, so how much would a dry suit cost? I mean, do people rent them, or do you need to buy your own?
You can rent if you're qualified to do so, or you can buy your own. And... you know, brand new retail prices can go from, you know, $900 all the way up to, I just saw a new one premiered at DEMA, which is the underwater convention. There's a Kevlar suit, which I think is going for $3,000. So that could be overkill for some people.
Right, right. So once you're wearing this thing, are you, are you going to stay warm as long as you stay down? Or is it like for half an hour you'll be warm? Or how does that?
You know, everybody's different. It depends on what kind of layers you wear underneath. It depends on your body. Mm-hmm. You know, some folks tend to stay warmer than others. Depends on your activity.
So give me an example of like what an outing would be like for you going diving. You were talking about Whittier? Or? Mm-hmm.
Sure, yeah. During the winter, I think most of us dive out of Whittier. Smitty's Cove there is a protected underwater park. So you meet up with your folks for us at the shop, grab all your gear, maybe grab some breakfast on the way. Carpool down there, change your clothes on the just the side of the tunnel in Whittier while you're waiting for it to open and go through. Then you get down to the cove, gear up, talk about your dive plan, and maybe it's snowing down there, maybe it's raining, maybe there's nothing going on, maybe the parking lot needs to be plowed. My favorite is when it's snowing, just a little bit. It's always really neat.
Why is it neat when it's snowing?
Well, I mean, you're standing here in Alaska, it's snowing, you're looking at the water.
I want to go in there.
You're wearing all this gear. Yeah, and then you you walk in, and it's just totally a different world. You know, have you ever been out fishing or on a boat in Alaska, and you just look and wonder what's under?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah, so we get to jump in and see. Uh-huh. It's really amazing.
So there's a place to change into your gear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we call it the warming hut, affectionately. Uh-huh. Sometimes it's warm.
So who operates that, or what is it like? Does a community thing?
Ish, do you want to weigh in on this, Scott?
It is kind of a little community thing. We none of us really know who owns it. It's just been traditionally provided to the divers, and the harbor master down in Whittier kind of keeps a key for us so that we can check it in and check it out. And it's kind of one of those things. It's one of those assets that we all try to protect so we can continue to use it. But it's not a formal anything. It's just a shack that we've used for years.
Very Whittier. That's sort of like a Whittier in a nutshell, right?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, we used to, years ago, we used to bring blue tarps and we'd spread them out inside of our vehicles. And that way, when we came out and we were dripping wet, we'd just climb in our truck and blast the heater. Mm-hmm. So going from that to an actual warm, you know, shack or shed or whatever you want to call it is quite a blessing for us in the middle of winter.
Wow. So tell me, you were talking about this moment when you were going from the snowy world down into the world below. I mean, what do you see when you first go down there? Or do you just walk into the ocean?
Yeah, you just walk down the boat ramp, do your final gear check, and make sure your buddies are ready and go under. Like I said, I like it when it's snowing because if you have good visibility, you can actually look up from, you know, 20 feet, 30 feet, and you can see the snow hit the surface of the water. Where else can you do that?
Very
it's pretty
cool.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, then you just drop down and make your way. You know, there's several underwater features down there and a lot of life. So, you know, you can look for the resident wolf eels. There's an octopus down there, maybe more than one. We've definitely seen the same one a few times, though.
Uh-huh.
And just kind of, you know, it's like seeing your old friends. You sort of go poke here, check around there, see, you know, who's home, so to speak.
Kind of like tide pooling below the ocean.
A lot like it, yeah.
Yeah. So, Scott, what kind of stuff do you, what's some of the more spectacular, interesting stuff that you've seen? Because you said everybody says that there's nothing to see in Alaska, but you say that there is.
Yeah, my favorite diving is summertime, actually. And we run a charter boat in Resurrection Bay, and we take out a dozen divers at a time on the weekends. And out there, once you get away from the shoreline a little bit further, the abundance definitely increases. And so we're diving mostly walls and pinnacles, a lot of structure. You know, we'll anchor up maybe 100 feet from a wall and we'll swim over to it and just drop down it and then just explore. And the thing about the walls and the rocky structure up here is it's all covered with invertebrate life. And so there's not an inch of bare ground, so to speak.
Wow.
Yeah, so
yeah, you don't really imagine that when you're out, you know, silver fishing in Resurrection Bay.
No.
You just sort of see these sheer walls, but it always sees rock and barnacles,
yeah.
Basically.
And that's, you know, that's indicative of the fact that, you know, what you're looking at goes dry half the time with the tide going in and out.
It's constantly battered by waves.
Yeah, so once you get down to 20 or 30 feet or so, then that kind of influence isn't there, and they actually thrive in that environment. And if you have a big bright light to illuminate the colors, it can be much more colorful than some of the other warm water destinations that people dive at.
Hmm. More colorful, like what kinds of organisms are?
Well, I'll give you an example. On a lot of the rocky substrate, it's there's an encrusting algae that's literally purple. So you hit it with a light, and all of a sudden the whole rock in front of you turns purple. And then on the purple, there's layers of additional life. So you may have anemones, or you may have different types of critters that attach themselves to the rock, and then they filter the water as the current goes by.
Hmm.
And so you've got layer after layer after layer, one on top of the other, all very colorful and all very interactive. And so you can literally sit in one spot for 30 minutes and be entertained, whereas, you know, when I go diving in Hawaii, I'm swimming along looking for something. Up here, I can stop and be entertained for half an hour without even kicking one bit. So, yeah, just the density is incredible up here.
Yeah. Otherwise, this is something that people don't really realize, because you think of the tropics as being totally rich, but in fact, the water there is weaker and has less oxygen, and our waters are very productive because there is a lot of oxygen because they're colder and, I guess, stirred up more, and also there's a lot of nutrients that come off of the land, and we have these huge plankton blooms in the spring. So Alaska is really very biologically rich underwater.
Alaska is really productive because you have nutrient-rich water. So you have upwelling, which is why there's so much diversity, and in the tropics, it's nutrient poor. All those nutrients have been used up.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely high diversity and productivity here.
Yeah, and and I never realized that there was more color, and I guess I don't know why there would be just more color, because there's more critters, do you think?
I think so. It's the critters that are colorful, yeah, so that stands to reason.
Uh-huh.
I would have to say that was spoken as a true Alaskan, that Alaskan diving is better than Hawaii, because I've been a lot of warm places that have pretty cool diving, too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Pretty colorful, but I love it here.
Yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer, and we're talking about diving, and we've got three guests in the studio, and we're going to be back in a moment to talk more about how you could get involved in diving. And also, I want to find out from our guests, like, what is the coolest thing they've ever seen, or what's the wildest thing, or what are some adventure places to go? But first, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to hear a piece about Bill Strever, who is an Alaska adventurer, biologist, and author. He's also a lifelong scuba diver. Alaska Public Media's video team followed Bill underwater at Summit Lake last year. Bill tells his story about what lures him underwater, even in Alaska's cold, icy winters. I'm Charles Wolforth. Stay with us as Outdoor Explorer continues.
I can go out in the forest, climb mountains, go hiking, go skiing in the winter, and enjoy being outside, enjoy being in nature. But going underwater gives me a whole new world to look at. We're in beautiful Summit Lake, Alaska, at about 1,300 feet, roughly halfway between Seward and Anchorage. It's ice diving season, so we've got a hole cut in the ice. So we're looking at about 18 inches or so of ice right now. And the ice underneath is very smooth and very clear. The ice closer to the surface has snow entrained with the ice, so it's white and it's opaque. It's almost like looking through a very, very thick piece of glass with some white translucent filters behind it. And in that thick piece of glass, you see things like bubbles. And as the ice thickens, it keeps trapping more and more bubbles over weeks and weeks of time. Really interesting to look at from underneath. My diving history goes way back. I learned to dive when I was, 14 years old, and I was diving in lakes in Georgia that had terrible visibility, nothing to see, and I loved every minute of it. Well, diving in Alaska is a lot better than diving in Georgia, I'll give it that. Diving in Georgia is called, I call it desperation diving. You're only doing it to get underwater. So everybody comes from all over the world. They come to Alaska to see our mountains, to see our wildlife. Another side of that is to see our diving, because we really do have fantastic diving in the state of Alaska. This is the longest I've ever lived anywhere. I feel, you know, everybody wants to say I'm an Alaskan. I guess you're not truly an Alaskan unless you were born here, and I wasn't born here, but I'm at home in Alaska. My son Ish, or Ishmael, he came to Alaska when he was only about 4 years old. I'm a big fan of the book Moby Dick, and it means a lot to me because Ishmael was sort of this seagoing philosopher, constantly reflecting about life and having adventures with Captain Ahab and the Great White Whale. And I spend a lot of time thinking about how I'm next going to get out on my next adventure, I suppose you would say. Ish sees himself as a big city kid. And you know, it's interesting, he's never lived in the big city. But he sees himself as a big city kid, and he would love to move to New York or to Chicago or LA. I definitely think Alaska can be a very tough place for kids, especially kids that are not real enamored with the outdoors. Now, he's his own man. I think he needs to do what's right for him, just like I did what's right for me.
When you're ready.
Okay.
Oh, ready?
Yeah. One.
More than anything else, I think I'm afraid of getting into a routine existence. It's just too easy to stop trying to do different things and to fall into a routine of a kind of a 9-to-5 job or something like that. But I've seen that in other people that I care about, other people that I know, my parents, for example, and I don't want my life to go that way. I think if you're spending a lot of time sitting around worrying about whether or not you're happy, you're probably not. You know, it's more something that comes to you without trying. And if you're trying, it's just probably means that something's missing. Alaska's kind of a blue-collar state. For some people, that translates into a redneck state. Snow machines and guns and beer. But that's definitely not the full truth. I actually find Alaskans to be very open-minded and generally very thoughtful people and also very well-educated people. Come here and spend a summer, spend a winter if you can. Get to know Alaska, get to know the people, spend a lot of time outdoors. It will change your life. Thank you.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we're talking about scuba diving, which, believe it or not, is an Alaskan sport, and there, you know, plenty of people doing it here. And as we learned in the first section, some pretty vivid stuff. We have a little bit of a debate in the studio as to whether Alaska or Hawaii diving is better. Maybe they could be different and each have their own good qualities. And I've got three guests with me. Scott Anderson is the owner of Dive Alaska. Eloise Brown is the dive program coordinator at Alaska Pacific University. Her diving is scientific, studying marine biology and oceanography while diving. And Emily Craver is the owner of the Last Frontier Diving Shop. Emily, there's a lot of reasons to want to get into diving. Maybe you want to do it on your vacation in Hawaii. Maybe you want to do a lot of diving here in Alaska. But it's a little bit daunting to think about how you would do it. What are the steps to becoming a certified diver?
Sure. So once you identify that desire and you want to learn to be a diver, I would, I'd visit around Anchorage, go to your local shop, see where you feel comfortable. Everybody is, qualified professional. We're a PADI shop, so that's our certifying body organization.
What does that mean?
Professional Association of Dive Instructors. So, and they're worldwide. So, if you start here diving with us, then you can go to another PADI shop somewhere else. And, you know what to expect from your PADI shops. And the first step is open water diver. So you do your pool work. You do your book work here.
What is a pool work?
So you practice your pool skills, practice all the skills that you need out while you're diving, but in the confined water of a pool.
So would you wear like a tank or from the very first lesson, or would you like sort of be just showing that you could swim, or what do you do on that first
there
lesson?
There are a couple tests to show that you can tread water and swim. Mm-hmm. And then we teach you all about the gear and how to put it on, take it off, take care of it, and you would actually put on the gear under supervision and get in the shallow end and go from there.
And is there anything, in terms of just wearing scuba gear and breathing through a regulator, Is there anything special that you need to know about how you breathe or anything, or do you just put it on and just go?
There's some steps that you go through for sure. It's always really interesting to see someone breathe underwater for the first time. Your brain tells you it's impossible or it doesn't seem natural, but you're doing it, so it's pretty neat. You want to make sure that you don't stop breathing. You're always continuously breathing, exhaling, not holding your breath. That's really important for safety.
And do you just that device that you wear gives you the right amount of air, and you just breathe in and out through your mouth normally, basically?
Basically, some are adjustable. So, if you need more air delivered, you can just turn a knob on the side and you'll get plenty.
Mm-hmm. So then you do this in the swimming pool until the instructor thinks you know what you're doing, and then what happens?
Well, you follow the prescribed lessons. Uh-huh. And then once you're done, then you would go to open water. You need to do 4 open water dives and do all your skills in open water as well. Show us that, you're proficient in these.
Would that be like in Whittier?
Sure. Or, in the summertime, like Scott was saying, we go out of Resurrection Bay or even Prince William Sound, Ketchikan Bay. It just depends on how far folks want to travel and what the conditions look like. You can also, for folks who are a little hesitant to dive here in Alaska, you can do what's called a referral program where you do your pool skills here and your book work, and then maybe you go somewhere warm to finish up and do your open water dives. And we have a lot of folks that do that. I always encourage people to do their full certification here. I feel like if you learn in Alaska, it's always going to be easier somewhere else.
All right. Because of the issues about the cold water and the dry suit makes
exactly.
it harder.
Yeah, so then when you go to some warm water destination and you jump in, I think you're so much better prepared.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can see that it makes a lot of sense, though, even if you only wanted to dive in Hawaii on your vacation, to get all the sort of the preparatory work done here. Otherwise, you're going to waste your vacation indoors or you know, doing the basic stuff before
yes.
you go down there.
Mm-hmm.
Huh, makes sense. So what do you need to learn that's special about using the dry suit? It's been brought up a couple of times about this buoyancy thing.
Sure, yeah, the buoyancy characteristics are different. You want to make sure that you have enough air in there so you're not getting a squeeze on your whole body, you know, as you descend, you go deeper. You're going to feel that pressure a little more, so you have to put more air in. But you don't want to have too much air or in the wrong places, because then you could find yourself going to the surface a little faster than you would like to. So air management.
So in other words, if you're too buoyant, you would tend to bob up to the surface, and that's dangerous. Is that
mm-hmm.
what you're
saying? Mm-hmm. And you're also wearing a lot more weight here to counteract the dry suit. So, you know, that can be an issue as well.
So learning how to figure that out, mm-hmm. basically. So how much does all this cost, just sort of in a general sense? Of like, if I come walk into your shop and say I want to be a diver, how much will I have to pay sort of to get through all the lessons and then for gear?
Sure. So if you want to go to full open water, everything that you need except for a mask, fin, snorkel is going to be $850. That's it. No, you know, oh, well, yeah, you need this, you need that. No, uh-huh. that's the cost. You do need to buy your own personal gear. So like I said, mask, fin, snorkel, some boots for your fins, perhaps some gloves. And then as you go, you know, you might want to buy your own dive computer, your own regulator, your own BCD, which is the vest that holds everything.
As opposed to renting that stuff.
Yeah. And then, you know, you have lights and knives and the newest, coolest stuff. Depends on how outfitted you want to
get. Got stuff for people to give you for Christmas at that point.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, and what about the lessons? How much do the lessons cost?
Oh, that was the price for the lessons.
Oh, okay.
The $850.
So then you're all set.
Mm-hmm.
Got you.
Mm-hmm.
So, Scott, is it sort of the same procedure with your dive shop? Any differences?
No. It's all, the standards are common, whether you're at one shop or another. The agency that Emily talked about, Patty, they set the standards that we operate by.
Mm-hmm.
So that determines how many times we visit the pool, how many classroom sessions, how many open water dives we do. And so that standardization is important for the student, because then when they go off and they meet up with their buddies and they go diving, they're all hopefully on the same page.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a typical student? I mean, who would be the type of person who walks in the door?
There's really not a typical, which is kind of the fun part about it, is we have all ages, from, you know, as young as 10 or 12 up to senior citizens, from, you know, the middle-aged housewife who finally gets her kids into school and has some time now to spend on herself, to, you know, the young military guy that is gung-ho to go out and do some exploring in our water. So we really have everybody kind of across.
Is there any, do you ever get somebody who just like, gets into it and says, I can't do this? Or, I mean, are there issues that come up where people find out this is not what they want to do?
Certainly. But, you know, a part of our job when we first talk to them is to try to help them sort through those issues. So there's times where we get to the pool and someone discovers, you know, discomfort with removing their mask underwater, for example. 9 times out of 10, we can work with them a little bit and get them to the point where they are comfortable and then continue on. But
when you say discomfort, they just are scared to do it?
Yeah. There's a lot of anxiety that goes on because it's totally different than what we're used to in our everyday lives.
You know what it strikes me as the thing that would make me anxious is having grown up on these Jacques Cousteau movies, which were great. I love them. But they're always talking about, you know, we can't go up, you know, we can't rise to the surface too fast. Or there's a lot of it, emphasis on hazards, you know, and on danger, which I guess is part of like creating a movie. But this issue about like going to the surface too quickly and getting the bends, I mean, how big of a hazard is that? And is that something that kind of is that one of the main things you have to really be worried about and thinking about?
Yeah, so you're referring to something we call decompression sickness,
mm-hmm.
and that comes from when we go down underwater and breathe compressed gas, our body absorbs and holds the nitrogen in the breathing gas, and then when we come up, it releases it. And so our job is to come up slowly so it releases it slowly instead of quickly in the form of a bubble that can cause an injury.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of what we do, is we we talk about the hazards and the dangers so that we can then talk about how to mitigate them, so then we can set them aside as no longer being the scary unknown. And once we've identified all the concerns and addressed them and trained for them, then it creates a diver who's more comfortable going out and going diving.
So if something goes wrong and you're sort of all the way down there, then you've just got to be calm and come up slowly? Or if you come up quickly, what happens then? I mean, what's
We train as buddy teams. And so you've always got a buddy. And so the first thing you would do is just turn and signal, communicate with your buddy that you have a problem. There are common procedures for everything that can go wrong. So over the years, of course, when things go wrong, we do analysis on them, and then we learn from them, and then we address a training issue that, or we create a training tool, perhaps, that will address that issue. And so mostly those fears are the fear of the unknown, and that's the education part. So once, once divers move through the educational process, those fears begin to subside, and it turns into excitement, and then once they become comfortable in the water, it's just plain old fun.
Right. Any issues that are different about Alaska in terms of dealing with hazards?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, we've got slippery, icy boat ramps that we're dealing with. You know, it's environmental things, the water temperature, the dry suit type stuff. But, you know, quite frankly, sometimes we get more credit than we're due when I travel. You know, we do a lot of trips all over the world, too, with our divers. And when we travel, we always kind of get the reputation of, oh, you guys are from Alaska. You must be used to, you know, whatever they saw on The Deadliest Catch. You know, we just simply don't dive in conditions like that. So we're the biggest wimps ever. If the water's too rough, we pull around the corner into a cove and we dive there. So it's really not as kind of dark and scary.
But you're not above walking to the bar in Hawaii and say, oh, yeah, I dive in Alaska.
Oh, no. I'll take the full credit for
it. Right. You got to, right? So what if you get a hole in the dry suit? I mean, I would think that would change your whole buoyancy equation, and that would be a hazard.
Yeah, the whole thing is, you know, it depends on the size of a hole. Something catastrophic could cause a problem. But more often than not, you discover a hole by coming out of the dive and realizing that you're wet. The undergarments that we wear, they're, you know, they're modern fibers that are, you know, like, for example, one of the fibers that we use will maintain 85% of its thermal capacity even when it's wet. And that's why we choose it, you know. And so the my favorite analogy when people say, well, isn't diving in Alaska too cold? There's no way I would do it. It's too cold. And I use the example of, like, going snow machining. People don't say, oh, I'm not going to go snow machining, it's too cold. Instead, they put on a coat and they go snow machining.
Right.
So same thing with diving. We put on an undergarment. We put on a waterproof suit. We put on appropriate thermal protection. And then we go diving and we have a good time.
Well, you know, it's there's a cultural thing here, too, which is that having grown up in Alaska like you guys, I was taught as a kid that the water is death. You know, whenever you fall in the water, you'll die like that. You know, and as you get older, you start to, I swim at my cabin in the ocean if it's a sunny day. And you realize, well, actually, that's not true. You could actually, you can swim around in it. But that there's sort of a, you're kind of taught as a kid to just beware of the water and how hazardous it is. And that makes, and diving, going under it, just seems even more extreme.
Right. So you take something that's already instinctually kind of scary, and then you add the reality of cold and the hazards that do exist to the person who's not properly dressed and prepared. And it's a real concern. And that's why we emphasize training so much.
Yeah. So in the scientific diving world, Eloise, do people come to it already being divers, or do scientists sort of say, okay, now I have to learn to be a diver? I mean, how do you get into it from that point of view?
Either way. So we do offer a basic open water class at APU for people who just, students who want to go to Hawaii on vacation, or they just want to get into it and see how they like recreational diving. And then the main objective of our program is to train scientific divers according to the AUS standards. So that's the American Academy of Underwater Scientists. So there are a lot of programs. It's an international organization. They're all across the U.S. and other countries as well. So a lot of universities will take beginning divers from they've never dove before all the way through to the end of scientific divers. Or you can come in as a open water certified and then start working on your scientific qualifications.
What differs in terms of the scientific qualifications from what we've been hearing from the two instructors?
So it's a lot. It's 100 hours of training on top of an additional your additional open water scientific or your open water diving. Yeah. So you have a lot more pool skills, and then you get to actually go out in the ocean and do transects and quadrets and learn all the scientific sampling type stuff.
So it's like how to work underwater.
It's how it's an occupational diving, right? How to work underwater. It also we also train people in rescue, so you get a full blown rescue scenario from the an unconscious diver. You know, I'm trying to say pretend. You know, and it's just an exercise. You take someone all the way from the bottom up to the surface and drag them to shore, and then practice administering any first aid that they may need. So we make sure our divers are really well trained before we send them out on research boats to remote areas.
Yeah. So where do you do most of this training for AP? Do you in Whittier, Kachemak Bay, or?
This fall class that I've been teaching, which has been the open water one, has all been in the pool and in Whittier. Next year, I'm hoping to take some of my students down to Seward and do a few dives in the Alaska Sea Life Center as well. And then next semester.
You said dives in the Alaska Sea Life Center?
Mm-hmm.
Like in the tanks?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
I'm pretty excited about that.
That sounds really cool.
My
I want to be there
too.
That day.
And then next semester, we'll be doing pool work and theory. And then in our we have a May block class, and we're going to go to Kasitna Bay Laboratory, University of Alaska has a lab down there. Yeah, we're going to go down there for a week.
That'll be great.
Yeah.
So what about Arctic? Do you or have any of your colleagues done diving in the Arctic?
I've been up there just to retrieve gear. And there are a lot of my colleagues in Fairbanks work up there. I'd love to start an Arctic research program, but I have not started one yet.
Sounds like that would add a whole an additional dimension if you're dealing with ice and everything else.
Well, it's only ice. It's ice-free in the summer, right? So you could go up in the summer and throw some instruments out, or there are some programs up in Fairbanks where they have heated ice melting rings, and they've gone out to look at, it's usually looking at habitat of essential fish species.
Yeah, the underside of the sea ice is supposed to be really interesting, full of life.
I'd love to study that.
Yeah, yeah. It's Outdoor Explorer. We're talking about diving today, and I have three guests in the studio. Eloise Brown, you were just hearing from, is the dive program coordinator at Alaska Pacific University. And earlier you heard from Scott Anderson of Dive Alaska and Emily Craver of Last Frontier Diving Shop. Right now we have another break. We're going to take a trip to Little Tutka Bay, which is just across Kachemak Bay from Homer. And that's near where that Kasitsna Bay facility is that Eloise was just talking about. Rick Harness runs an ecotourism business there, and he tells our producer Monica Goki about life alongside the water and even under the water. Harness is an avid scuba diver. I'm Charles Woolforth. Stay with us.
My name is Rick Harness, and I live in Little Tutka Bay. I have an ecotour business, so I take tourists out to play with the wildlife, explore the bays and islands and lagoons. Most people come over by boat. Some people come over by float plane. People in our area travel mostly by skiff, rowboat, or kayaks. And kayaks are more and more popular as time goes. And of course, you'll see more and more people traveling that way. Yeah, we've been doing our kayaking business for a few decades now. And so it's just a way of life. In the summertime, we have one of the richest plankton counts that you'll find anywhere. And as the spring progresses, the waters turn green and greener. But on the shoulder side of season, in winter times, you know, the water clears up, and it's amazing. It's like taking a jungle walk, you know, with all the kelps and the kelp forests underwater there. And it has such a diverse, you know, marine life. Every once in a while, something will be shadowed off to one side of you, and you look, and pretty soon you find out, oh, there's an otter that's curious coming to check you out. And I've had sea lions come right up to my face mask and stare me down, and it's fun, but it's quite unnerving. And Yeah, amazing activity to be able to do, because the world above is so rich, but down below is even richer yet. Everybody that comes to visit seems to say it's one of the most beautiful places they've ever visited, so that says a lot.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and today we are talking about diving, scuba diving in Alaska. And we have two dive shop owners in the studio, Scott Anderson of Dive Alaska and Emily Craver of Last Frontier Diving and Adventures, along with Eloise Brown, who is the dive safety coordinator for APU's dive program. And I wanted to talk more about some of the cool, interesting places that you guys have been and things that you've seen underwater. Eloise, you're talking about sort of, it sounds like you're at the bottom of the ocean with a clipboard and you're counting little critters, but you must see some interesting stuff down there. I mean, just in terms of spectacular stuff, exciting stuff.
Absolutely. You know, I was thinking, and I have to agree with Emily that my favorite moment is always right at the surface when you're just going down or you're just coming up, and I get so excited that I'm getting paid to do this. I remember thinking that one time in Dutch Harbor, it was one of the coldest dives I'd ever done, and we had a long surface swim, and I came up from the dive and just looked at these spectacular mountains all around me, and I get really excited about that. Covered
I'm
with
sure.
snow.
Yeah, and the surface of the water looks really cool from underneath too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what about wildlife? You were talking about diving inside the tanks at the Sea Life Center. One of the things that's always really blown my mind about visiting Sea Life Center is seeing the puffins and other Alsa's marine birds, flying underwater. And I'm interested in like what kind of wildlife encounters. I want to hear this from all three of you guys, actually. When you see like birds underwater, do you see like sea lions and birds and all kinds of stuff, the big Alaska wildlife underwater?
I've seen a few sea lions underwater mm-hmm. in my time. It's always amazing how fast they swim by. You're like, what was that?
I know. I think that's crazy. I've seen that from my boat, and it looks like they go as fast as like a swallow or something goes through the air, and yet these huge 1,000-pound creatures, and they just zoom along.
So I, another time I was diving out of Dutch Harbor as a volunteer this time, I was down with my clipboard counting snails on a rock, and my dive buddy started tapping me. I'm like, I'm fine. And he's like really tapping me, and I kind of looked up, and he's like, we got to go up now, and he points, and we're surrounded by a group of five or six juvenile stellar sea lions, but these are the big subadult ones. And I remember just looking around like, why do I worry about bears when I'm on land? All I can really do is blow bubbles at these guys, and they're looking at us like, what can we do? And apparently they've been pulling his fins the entire time he was counting the snails. They weren't bugging me, but they were really bugging him.
They were like nipping at her.
They were just playing. They were just curious, you know, but he didn't like it.
But they're like 5-6 times larger than you are.
Yeah, like
or
the
more.
Size of a bear surrounding us.
They could do anything they want.
And I was like, oh my goodness. So he looked at me and he said, you go up and, I'll watch you. And I said, you go up and we'll go up together. He's like, no, you go up and I'll watch you. I was like, okay. So I went up, and as I went up, they all followed me and left him down there. And I can tell you, I have never gotten in a Zodiac faster. I got in with all of my gear. Usually you take your gear off, and then I got in the boat with everything, all 100 pounds of it.
Wow.
And then I sat there looking over the side like, please come up, buddy. And he came up. I'd never been so happy to see him. They were fine, they wouldn't have done anything, but it was, it was an eye-opener for me.
You guys jump in on this, but I mean, are there wildlife that's really, like killer whales eat animals that are about people size? I've never heard of one eating a person except at SeaWorld.
Yeah, no, there hasn't been a case in the wild.
No.
So, an analogy I like to use, like we're talking about predators with very honed senses, right? So
they know what they're looking for.
Yeah, I mean, the tanks that we're wearing, they put off a huge magnetic signature that's not like their food.
Right.
And so I always think of it like, it'd be like me mistaking my tennis shoe for a steak. Because it's, I get it, it's a tennis shoe, and they get it too. Mostly my concern is just their curiosity. The sea lions are curious enough about us that they'll come and sometimes, mouth you a little bit or something like that. I've never known anybody that has gotten hurt by them. But I've had them mouth my arms, my legs, pulling my fins, that kind of stuff. And they'll come up to you and they'll get right in your face and look at you with their big eyeballs. And it's kind of curious and kind of intimidating. But then when they leave, it's kind of exhilarating, and it was kind of cool. So
yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I remember just being super excited afterwards. Yeah. I wasn't worried it was going to bite me. I just thought, I'm breathing underwater. I hope it doesn't pull on my ring or anything. Yeah. I'd like to get back out of the water now.
What about sharks? Do we have any sharks that are dangerous here?
No.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're salmon shark, but they don't. Yeah. They're so timid that they won't come around us. Mm-hmm. It's real hard to get next to.
You must
to
have
them.
Had to be careful about that in Australia, sharks.
Yep. We had a few issues with white pointers in Australia. The scientific divers, they all wear shark shields, which is this meter-long electrified cable that you strap on your ankle and basically gives your calf a cramp for your entire dive. It's supposed to send out some magnetic force field, and sharks will leave you alone.
And it works? You sound skeptical.
She's here.
Yeah. You're still alive.
You know, there's a lot of debate about it. I've seen videos that were very convincing that it does work. Uh-huh. Some people are skeptical. I don't know. Mostly it made diving uncomfortable for me because I had this thing zapping me for the entire time I was diving.
But. You should be aware of it. Yeah. Emily, what cool wildlife sightings you've had or things you've seen that were very memorable?
Yeah, I'm with them on the sea lions here. They are faster than you realize and bigger, and they seem to come out of nowhere, and they're very curious. It's always fun to run into them. I seem to bump into them at Boulder City, which is a dive site in Resurrection Bay, every time I'm there. You know, I find everything fascinating, from the micro life. I'm a big shark fan. Been trying to see the salmon sharks, but haven't had a lot of luck here. Like Scott said, they're timid. Probably one of the most exhilarating dives I did with sharks. We were in Playa del Carmen. We travel all around the world and take trips. And there's a small window of time in November every year when they have the bull sharks that come through. And so we were in the water with pregnant bull sharks. And it was really amazing. But they didn't get very close. I mean, 20, 25 feet maximum. But just to watch them, you know, sharks moving like any other creature I've seen underwater, and I could just watch them all day. Mm-hmm. It's pretty amazing. Of course, I didn't have the encounters that you had in Australia.
Oh, I never saw a white pointer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you don't see them coming. That's sure. What they say.
Right, well, until it's too late. Yeah.
Okay, stay in Alaska. Yeah. Right. So, Dave, what about some, do you have some good wildlife stories?
Yeah, I mean, speaking of sharks, that was probably...
I should have said Scott. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's all right. You looked right at me. I knew who you're talking about. But yeah, I think sharks sometimes, because of Shark Week and that kind of stuff, I want to be real careful not to demonize them and unfairly paint them as this, you know, predator that's out to get us. Typically,
or Sharknado, if any of us have seen that great film, right?
Yeah, the worst. Yeah, usually they're not out to get us at all. And so, you know, I love watching them. And one of my favorite encounters was in Galapagos one time. And it was with whale shark and also hammerheads. And probably my all-time favorite, we had done a dive and we were at about 80 feet and due to the current, you'd have to just sink and hold on to a rock. And then you just watch the whole world go by and it just drifts by at about a knot, about a mile and a half. And when we were done with our dive, it came time to ascend back up to the boat. We let go of the rocks and took a deep breath to start us up. And about 40 feet in this current, I looked down current and I saw a school of hammerhead sharks that were probably about 60 or 70 strong.
Wow.
And we were drifting right into the middle of them. And there's nothing, you can't go up fast like we talked about earlier. I couldn't go down. I'm low on gas. I can't go around them. So I had decided I'm going through them. And I kind of tucked my arms and legs and fingers in a little bit and they parted just like, you know, parting of the seas.
Wow.
It was just amazing. And our group of four divers drifted into the middle of them. They closed behind us and then they and just kind of continually opened a path as we drifted through the middle of the school of them. And we came out the back of that. We looked at each other and we screamed and we whooped and we hollered and it was pretty exhilarating. But
wow.
Yeah, just amazing. And they don't, you know, they look at us like, why are you in our way? And they're not, they're not looking for us. They're looking for food. Huh.
So the thing about your story that was striking me that I didn't understand is like you have to just float with the current rather than swimming against it just to save energy?
Yeah, you can't fight the current. It's just too powerful. So, you know, that's what we call a drift dive. And the plan is that you'll drift along and then the boat will drift along above you. And we've got a little signal device that we can inflate and send to the surface. And that communicates with the boat where we're at. And so it might take us 10 minutes to ascend from 80 feet to the surface, and we might cover a mile and a half, but the little chase boat follows right along. So as soon as we pop up, there's the boat, and when we climb out. So it's a great way of diving.
A little bit like ballooning. You don't know exactly where you're going to end up.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, you know, as a lot of fishermen in Alaska, I think, you know, you develop this imagination for what it looks like down there when your lure is hanging down and you're trying to catch a salmon or something. Like, how many are there? Like, are they everywhere? They're just ignoring my bait? Or is like, just I'm hoping for one to wander by? You really don't know.
You know, it's hilarious. We have dive sites which are popular fishing sites. Mm-hmm. And you'll go down, you'll see where the fish are, what species they are, where exactly they're hanging out. And then you come up and you look at all the fishing boats and you're going, you're not going to catch one. You're not going to catch one. You're not going to catch one. And it's kind of an unfair advantage, but I don't really fish anymore anyways. So, there's schools of rockfish.
So you'll see them in big schools and you'll sort of know, you could just see where somebody should drop their bait and then catch
rockfish are like that. You can see the schools of rockfish and they tend to hang out, which is what makes them so vulnerable. Mm-hmm. The other species, halibut, not so much. We don't really see too many of them. The salmon are a little bit more skittish. Ling cod, we'll see one or two at a time just because of the stock level right now isn't so high. But then when you get further out in, you know, more pristine areas, you'll see all of that even more.
And how deep are you going typically in these recreational dives?
Yeah, about 100 feet is our limit. Uh-huh. Much beyond that, and it's called technical diving, and that requires additional training and a different blend of gases and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, and halibut typically would be deeper than that, I suppose.
Probably, yeah. There's stories of, you know, 50-foot shelves off Montague that I haven't been able to dive yet, but at this point they're in the story status.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So we're almost out of time here, but I'm just interested in Emily's, you haven't talked about sort of fish and critters and stuff that you've run into out there. I mean, do you have any?
I mean, you have all the usual suspects, you know, your rockfish, uh-huh. Your invertebrates, the occasional otter. I've heard whales, but never seen any underwater.
Is this your sort of season, you know, we're in March? I mean, is this a good time to be, for people to be getting into diving? And
oh, yeah. And what's your alternative in the winter? Snow machining, you get a runny nose. You get cold, you get windy. My friends make fun of me, you know, because
it's always above 32 down there, right?
Exactly. I love winter diving. I mean, I love it anytime, but it's a fun winter activity for sure.
Yeah, great. Well, I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. It's been really interesting. It's kind of made me want to give it a try, and probably some of our listeners too. That was Emily Craver, who is owner of the Last Frontier Diving and Adventures, and earlier heard from Scott Anderson, owner of Dive Alaska, and Eloise Brown is with Alaska Pacific University. And we'll be back next week with another show about Alaska's outdoors. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Monica Gokey, and I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.